Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I will be in New York City, October 26th, at a conference. You can Google it. It's called R.D. Lang. It's L-I-A-N-G, R.D. Lang in the 21st Century. It's a fascinating conference about one of the most interesting, stimulating figures in the history of psychiatry who had a great deal of influence on me when I was a youngster. It's called R.D. Lang in the 21st Century, and I'll be talking on Saturday at 1, but the conference is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I haven't been in New York City for a conference in years, and I don't have anything on the immediate horizon for the future after the R.D. Lang in the 21st Century conference. So I hope to see you there. Now, my guest today is Howard Glasser, Howie Glasser. Howie is a friend. He's an exciting speaker. In fact, one of my more trusted friends said that listening to the tapes of our conferences, of our empathic therapy conferences, which I hadn't thought to advertise, but you can get them on empathictherapy.org, that Howie was the next best speaker to me. Reaffirmed from my feelings that, of course, Peter, you're the best, but she's a good friend. So that was pretty big endorsement from my viewpoint. A person of great judgment. Howie's the author of Transforming the Difficult Child, which he writes is the best-selling book on the topic of ADHD, the Inner Wealth Initiative, which is a book on school interventions, and the title that I love, You Are Oprah, Igniting the Fires of Greatness. And I think that really captures Howie, Igniting the Fires of Greatness. He's been on radio and TV and stuff like that. I think one of the more exciting things is the influence that he's had on many school programs and some programs in the military and elsewhere. Now, Howie, you're listening, right? You're there?
Yes, I am.
Well, listen, now, the next sentence, I'm taking this right out of what you said,
okay,
raises all kinds of issues for us. Your next sentence is, he is proudest of the fact that he is responsible for keeping more children off psychiatric medicines than perhaps any other living person.
Well, that might not include Peter Bregan. I should reconsider that line. I think you are, by far. I don't have the following you have, though. I need to learn how to get out there more.
Well, I think that you have a huge following and in many ways greater than me, but I do think that also some of what you're doing with the medication stuff is based on my work, right?
It is. You know, you really began that for me. And when I wrote my book, 101 Reasons to Avoid Ritalin Like the Plague, you know, I really only had a couple of burning reasons why I shared this point of view. For me, it was, I don't like giving kids the message that something's wrong with their life force, their intensity, we need to make it go away, that they can't handle it and we can't handle it. And there were a couple of other reasons. And to fill in the 101 reasons, I leaned heavily on a man I didn't know at the time, Dr. Peter Bregan. And I have been hugely influenced by you. I think the place where I really do prevention is that my work is attractive to a lot of people in schools, and by way of that, they wind up keeping kids off medication before it ever starts, and that was my reference. You're the one who gets out to millions and millions of people, and you tell them the reasons why medication is to be avoided and why it's just not a good idea, and I love you for that. I love your verve, and I love your boldness and your wisdom is huge. So I'm a great Peter Reagan fan. Sorry.
So listen, one of the things I like to tell people is you're one of the few therapists who comes to my mind when I'm having difficulty, especially working with children, but really with anybody I'm working with, and I start to feel stuck. And I just remember that you keep telling us, look for the greatness in the person you're working with. And that pretty much is going to get you out of any trouble you're in as a therapist.
Yeah, you know, I think we get ourselves in pickles as ways to find our greatness. And a lot of times what looks like a problem is really somebody exploring their greatness, and they need a wise counsel to say, hey, are you aware of this? You know, yes, you are going through this with your friend. And yes, you are, you know, but look at what you're doing. You're reaching deep into the truth of who you are, and that's a great quality. And nobody's understanding your reasons for doing what you're doing, so you're relying on yourself. That's a huge quality of your greatness that's coming forth in this dilemma. You know, so I find that to be true, that when I look for greatness, I find it. And you know, I was a fan of Artie Lang too. Did you know that? And his huge thing in my life that's pervaded my work is creating a first-hand experience, not a second-hand experience. And maybe I completely misunderstood the man. I went to England to kind of find him when I was graduating, when I got my master's degree. What I'm trying to say here is I like pointing to things and saying, look at you now. Look at what you're telling me or showing me. That is you demonstrating greatness right there, and make it a firsthand experience. So I thank Dr. Lang for that.
Did you get to meet him?
I did. You know, I went to meet two people. I got to meet Dr. Joshua Beer, who was a pioneer in the work of milieu therapy at the time, and he and a woman I work with in New York at New York's Postgraduate Center for Mental Health, they were the authors of the 6 existing articles on milieu therapy, and they were both striving to get mental patients out of mental hospitals in the early 70s when that was afoot. And I'm sure you were part of that as well. And I also had it in mind that I wanted to go meet my hero, Dr. Lang. I don't know if I even understood 2 words of what he said, but I loved his boldness. I loved his courage and honesty.
He wrote a couple of books, The Politics of Experience.
Yes.
I think it was the best-selling book. It was a huge seller. And he wrote a book that I thought was very important, co-authored with Aaron Esterson, on the family. And folks who want to get an interesting view of psychosis, or what gets labeled schizophrenia — he didn't believe in the labels either — and how it relates to family life. It's a great book. Just look up R.D. Lang and Aaron Esterson and put family book or something like that in the title. You can find it.
Did you work with him as well? Did you get to meet him as well?
No, I never got to meet him. I'm going to be the only person at this conference that never worked with him, I think. But I think they feel I carry his torch to some extent. So,
I believe you do, my friend. I truly believe you do.
Now, tell the folks about the nurtured heart approach, what it is and how you teach it, and give them a sense of what it is your work's about.
I'd be happy to. It came out of my work as a family therapist, and I think noteworthy, before I explain the essence of it, is I had fresh eyes. I don't know if you know this, Peter, but I had dropped out of my doctoral clinical psychology work for for 12, it must be 10 or 12 years, I dropped out and I did woodworking. And at some point, I kind of knew that there was a chance I'd go back to psychology, to psychotherapy. What was interesting about the timing was I had enough life experiences that a lot of what I learned, I still remembered, but I wasn't married to it anymore. So I got back. I think if I had stayed all the way through school, I would have been like everybody else, and I would have signed up on a party line, and I would have been, a card-carrying psychologist and pompous and stuck, not that all psychologists are that way at all, but I would have been, stuck in a mud. And what was noteworthy is I had gotten married and I moved to from Colorado to Tucson and immediately got a job at a family clinic. And I pretty immediately found that the things I learned in school weren't getting me anywhere. And not that methods and philosophies and theories don't work. They probably work for some people. But my trying to explore why a family was in this situation with their kid or try and heal the emotions of it, as much as I tried, it was actually, to my eyes, making things worse. So I had fresh eyes. It was almost like I could see the energy of the interactions and relationships between parent and child. And what I realized was I was giving them advice that was actually making things worse. And it led me to be very compassionate for the families and go, oh, well, they're probably already giving the same advice to their kids. They want them to stop doing what they're doing that's offensive, and they want them to start doing the right thing. And, I started to see a pattern, and the pattern was that when parents so want their kids to be honest and responsible and respectful and all that great stuff, and when they are doing it, they barely say thank you, if that, and good job. When they aren't doing that, they get lit up, like a Christmas tree. They get all excited and juicy. And I think we all want better broadband. None of us want to go back to dial-up. We all want great connection. And some intense kids are just hungrier than the next person to have that great connection. And they come to realize that it's much more available for doing wrong things, that their parents lean in, they could smell their mom's perfume, they could hear their dad's heartbeat when things are going wrong. And when things are going right, they barely get any energy. And I started to build a theory based on energy, and I started to see that if we played with that and we changed things around so that parents gave kids very highly appreciative, grateful energy for the good decisions they were making when things weren't going wrong, when the problems weren't happening, and if the parents got really good at not giving energy when things went wrong, but yet held the child accountable in a very simple, non-punitive way. So it's not ignoring. Ignoring would be letting problems go completely. This was holding kids very accountable, but not giving energy to it. When the parents got that formulation kind of in balance, kind of all going at once, all of a sudden these intense kids who were going awry, the same intensity started feeding this pattern of greatness. And then the parents were there applauding the greatness, and all of a sudden you had this wonderful kid. And I got to see that these same kids who were so symptomatic, who would have summarily been put on medication, were, 4 or 5 weeks later, were wonderful kids who, parents, and at that point, the parents couldn't care why their child had been, upsetting. They were now rejoicing that things were fine and they had this wonderful kid. And and the kid was feeling great about the new renewed relationship too. So in a nutshell, that's what the nurtured heart approach is. It's an approach that follows the energy of relationship and gets it aligned, realigned, and it's kind of fun. It's easy. It's really easy.
Howie, give some examples. You're good at that.
Okay. You know, I haven't had a private practice in a long time. I've mostly been concentrating on training trainers and teaching and writing. And
now you actually give good examples.
One example I love because it's so vivid to me is I remember I had I was referred to a six-year-old who was actually a student at a school I considered to be much better than other schools. But they met their match, this little kid named Joseph, and he was off the rails. And even though they had a method that worked with a lot of kids, they had no idea what to do with him. He got kicked out of class most days before 10 a.m., and when he got kicked out, he got sent to the office, and on days that he felt very needy, he'd throw himself down on the floor and pitch a fit. And in my mind, he was being treated like energetic royalty. You know, when he's in the office, he had five or six people hovering over him and feeding his negativity with their, you know, they were giving the gift of them. They were the prize, and he was getting the prize. And so I got to work with the parents, and it was young graduate students. They were in their early 20s. They were, you know, very academic-oriented people, but they loved their kids, and they were completely overwhelmed with their kids. So, and Joseph, in their mind, Joseph had never been anything other than oppositional and defiant. 6 years old. So, I started working with him, and I gave him the methodology of my approach. There's a way of thinking, and there's a way of connecting with kids through a couple of techniques I have. And, so I got them going in that. I got them thinking in the right direction. I got them going. And I remember saying to them, you know, one thing with oppositional kids is you can't ask them ordinary questions like could you, would you, please. You can't make ordinary requests because that conveys an option. And if he's feeling needy, he's not going to do what you want him to do because he'll get you to fall apart and he'll get lots of connection and energy. And I said, when you have a request, just say, I need you to, Joseph. I need you to do this. Here's what I want you to do. And I said, to get things going and start a new pattern, ask them things that are very, very simple. So I gave them an assignment to do some of this stuff, and the father rolled his eyes and looked at me like I was a lunatic and said, you don't get it. Joseph's never done anything we've asked him to do. So I said, well, then make it even more foolproof. So the next week, the dad comes back with a big smile on his face, and I said, how'd you do it? He said, Joseph was getting in the car. I glanced in the mirror. The door was partially closed. It was on its way to being closed. He had pulled the door closed. And I turned to him, and I said, Joseph, I need you to close the door. I said, that's brilliant. What'd you do next? I made a big deal. Joseph, thank you for following my directions. I really appreciate that you listened and you did exactly what I wanted you to do, and that shows me your cooperation. And what'd you do next? Well, I heard the seatbelt click, and I turned to him, and I said, Joseph, I need you to put your seatbelt on. I said, that's a home run. It's already in the bank. What'd you do? And he said, well, I appreciated him like you asked me to do. I said, Joseph, thank you. You were one step ahead of me there. It's almost like you knew what I wanted, and you did it without even being asked. To make a long story short, 2 weeks later, you could say to Joseph, I need you to do your homework, or I need you to go clean your room. And even if he was occupied with something, like watching TV, he'd stop what he was doing and go do what was requested. Because they had they really began this new way of relating with him. And Joseph was drawn into seeing that he didn't have to go to the trouble of acting out to have relationship. He could have stunning relationship through his good choices. How's that?
Good example. Good example. Talk about how you talk to kids or teach people to talk to kids about their greatness.
Well, you know, in a variety of ways. You know, greatness wasn't even in my vocabulary, until I started experimenting on me about 10 years ago. And I wanted to see how far you could go in the realm of radical appreciation. So when I'm working with a family, I really try to convey that there is this whole arena of greatness that's virtually untapped. We hardly ever tell our kids about qualities of greatness. I think we all have our own personal constellation of qualities that make us kind of like other human beings, like you and I have a lot of shared qualities of greatness that make us feel appreciative of one another. We're both compassionate human beings. We both care about children in a huge way. We're both very concerned about what's happening in our world and what the dilemma we see happening. And then I think you have unique qualities and I have unique qualities, and that's what makes us individuals. So I find different ways to explain and show parents, here's your child demonstrating greatness right now, and here's how your child's doing it. And then sometimes the thing that I say that really sells them on it is this, Peter, how not great would it be if your child, while we were talking, was interrupting? How not great would it be if your child started cussing and swearing right now? How not great would it be if your child was calling you names and being aggressive in his behaviors right now? And the parent goes, it would be very not great. Well, you know, in a way, that's a barometer of what is great. So then how great is it that he's choosing to use his good judgment and choosing to be respectful and choosing to follow the rules and choosing to be cooperative and collaborative? Do you see my point? You know, and kind of I'd back him into not so much a corner, but I kind of backward engineer. Here's what's not great, and therefore here is what's great, and can I help you see that in your child? Once they start saying things like that, it's almost like the child sits up an inch higher. I think we've all signed up for greatness, every last one of us, and we forget. We arrive on planet Earth, and the gravity of our lives is so diametrically opposed at times. We're born into families that say how not great we are. We find ourselves in educational situations that kind of stunt our growth and kind of and don't necessarily honor our greatness. We forget. And I think part of the joy and bliss in life is remembering our greatness and living our greatness and then finding our purpose. I mean, I know you enough to know the answer to this. Is your joy in life is very connected to your mission and your purpose in life, and you're one of those rare human beings who's living his purpose, and that's part of your greatness, isn't it?
It's certainly how I think about myself is that I have this purpose or this mission,
mm-hmm.
and that it's a very guiding principle or force, mm-hmm. practically instructions.
I think our greatness is what gives us real bliss. I think when we're not sure who we are and we've forgotten, we think of, we go to the bar and try and find bliss, or we do all kinds of things that are obscure and convoluted to try and find bliss. But then once you get, once you start seeing yourself as a great human being amongst other great human beings, then all of a sudden you get a little rerouted and you start going, oh, my bliss is, you know, the real joy is living the dream, living, you know, purposefully, giving to other people, seeing other people thrive, contributing in all these various ways, having fun. You know, it changes. And it's fun to see kids emerge into their greatness early on. It's fun to see schools that are doing this with kids. I now know a bunch of teachers, many schools. I just came from a school in North Carolina, Sally B. Howard School for the Performing Arts. Amazing people. I work. We did a training for their entire staff, from teachers to administrators to auxiliary staff, and it's a very reverent community. And I probably had a dozen people come up to me after or during the training and saying, you know, I've had so much love in my heart. You know, it's been inspired by my faith, my religion. This method has given me a way to be loving. It's kind of a manifesto. They didn't use the word manifesto, but, you know, it's kind of an instruction manual on how to enact my lovingness. And it gives people gratification to be in that greatness. You know, I think that's a greatness so many of us share in common, is we've signed up to be loving, and then we find it's frustrating when we try and be loving and it backfires. I think there's a quiet epidemic that leads to kids on medication, which is there's so many loving, smart parents out in the world, I'm sure your work confirms this, that are having really hard times with their kids, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure.
And it goes under the radar, you know. Some of it, you know, it's just like quiet despair, and some of it, you know, kids, you know, parents bring their kids in for a consultation, and you know, and I know, that you know, you blink an eye, and if it's an ordinary medical professional, you know, there's a likelihood if there's anxiety, a depression, or a black cloud hanging over a kid's head, you know, there's a recommendation for medication.
You know, Hallie, I think we can say that. Whereas good therapy encourages a person to find their greatness, their purposes, their beauty, their meaningfulness, psychiatry diminishes people, makes them think that none of those issues, their purposes, their goodness, their greatness, that none of that matters, that it's not even under their control, and that they are at the mercy of their brains and they need to be drugged. And when you're drugged, it's really hard to find your greatness. Really hard.
That's been my experience too, Peter. In my mind, the drug gets in the way. When I wrote the Ritalin book, it was not long after the movie Supersize Me. So, who was Jay Haley's wife at the time? Was Chloe Madonis. I found myself at a dinner. I was at the networker conference, and some of the people were going out, and I was sitting at I had this incredible opportunity to have dinner with some very interesting people like Frank Pittman and Richard Schnarch and Chloe Madonis, and she's sitting next to me, and we got to talking about this book, and she said, I told her I was thinking maybe I should do like a 30 days of being on Ritalin or something like that. And she said, oh, yes, you got to do that. So I went home, and I talked to my physician, who's a friend, and I said, you know, here's what I'm thinking, and would you be interested in being a part of this and journal for, you know, you give your clinical impressions while I write about my experience. And he said, absolutely, I'm in. I said, well, can you give me a prescription for Ritalin? And he said, oh, I can't do that without diagnosing you. So 10 minutes later, I had a prescription. I was at Walgreens. So he actually said, why don't you do 10 days? And 2 days, the point of the story is 2 days into being on Ritalin, Peter, if something went well, I didn't know if it was me or the Ritalin. And if something went poorly, I didn't know if it was me or the Ritalin. So it impacted my ability to believe in myself. And I believe if you're on a spiritual quest to be a better person, one way you improve on yourself is you put your finger on the pulse of your life. And if something goes well, you want to do more of it. If something goes poorly, you want to do less of it. And that's part of how we learn as human beings. But when you're on medication, you're kind of, it's Groundhog's Day. You're out of the loop. You don't know who you really are. And so you never go anywhere. It's very frustrating. I don't know. Does that fit your way of seeing things, too?
Eloquently. Folks, you're listening to my friend, my great friend, Howie Glasser, Glasser. Bring on the music with that inspiring commentary, and we'll come back after the break with more from Howie Glasser. Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan again with Howie Glasser. By the way, did you hear those ads? They keep saying rate me on iTunes. I've been doing these shows for a long time. I've never asked anybody to rate me on iTunes. I'm not even sure what it means to rate me on iTunes, but please go do it. Rate me on iTunes. I do know that this is one of the most listened to shows on PRN, and well, let folks know it. Rate me on iTunes, whatever that means. All right, back to, and come see me and say hello and say you listen to the radio show at the R.D. Lang in the 21st Century on Staten Island at Wagner College, not this weekend, but the following weekend, Saturday the 26th, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, R.D. Lang in the 21st Century. You can see how much Lang has meant to folks that here randomly I have on my show Howie Glasser, who thought enough of R.D. Lang to go and meet him and then apparently not understand a word he said. R.D. Lang was a shy man, from what I understand. But on to Howie, who handles the mic marvelously. Go.
Hi, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is, Howie. You get me all revved up.
You get me all revved up. It's great. It's great. I was telling a dear friend of mine this morning that you have this wonderful complexity of humor and compassion and wisdom and just saying it as you see it, trusting your guidance, trusting what experiences have led you to see the beauty of the human being and not wanting to mute it with medication, not wanting to endanger people with medication. You read into the truth of people and you don't want to put their lights out with medication. And I cherish that with you.
It's very, very kind. And folks, you can see that Howie brings life to people. He brings encouragement. He sees what's good in them and articulates it in, say, my case, better than I do or would. And that's a gift. So tell us some more. You work with children. You work with adults. Your work has influenced schools and the military. You work in counsel. You've worked training people in marriage counseling settings. Open the door wider to who you are, Howie.
You know, I have a pretty miraculous life. You know, I didn't plan on sharing Nurtured Heart Approach. You know, I was just watching what was happening in fascination, and I was innocently going about my business and having a private practice, and I reluctantly agreed to do a little presentation for a local organization. I had no presentation skills. I had no desire to present my work, but they kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me, and I kept saying no for the longest time. Eventually, I agreed to it, and I did like a half day presentation, and it was very overwhelming. I remember telling myself, never again, I'm not going to do this. And I ran into a guy at the health food store a few weeks later. It's probably a month or two later. And he introduces himself and he says, hi, I'm Armando Zurita, and I run the family preservation program at that organization. And I got to tell you, there's 10 people I supervise, and we're pretty much all using your approach, and we're having phenomenal results. And it was like, how'd that happen? What am I supposed to do with that? You know? And it's probably, you know, I'm sure you've had experiences like that. You know, it opened me up to, okay, I there's a bigger thing going on here. I need to do something. So I wound up opening a clinic and training a few people to be on our staff. And, you know, we had an agreement that they could use whatever methods anywhere else, but this clinic was going to be known for the nurtured heart approach. And then I just kept watching the moving ball. And I was the trajectory of my career was I was given what I would call the ordinary sundry ADHD type symptomatology in the first year or two. The universe took it easy on me, and I came to see those kids as a piece of cake after a while. And then the universe started kind of turning up the dial and giving me the much, much more challenging kids, gang kids and kids who were out on the streets, kids who were drug and alcohol, whatever, you know, like very tough kids. And I just kept playing with the methodology to make it tighter and stronger. And what's fascinating is now that my work is in print and, you know, I have a bunch of books, people are finding their way to this work. So I met some people from India in the last couple of weeks who are determined to take my work there. My work has made it through a few key people to New Zealand and Australia, and they are training people there, and they have it in schools. This year I did a training in the UK that had 50 people from the UK and then a handful of other people from Europe. And a lot of these people are out there in their own careers as educators or therapists or treatment professionals, and they are sharing this work out with other people. So, I have a very interesting life, and I'm just watching these patterns emerge. We had a global summit this year where people came and shared how they're using, people who are trainers in this work, who get certified, there were people using this work with meth addicts and people, a whole bunch of people using this creatively in education, in treating fetal alcohol syndrome and treating kids on the spectrum, using it in early childhood education, in the group home, residential treatment, just this whole growing range of places where children who have been in trouble, like foster care and adoptive care, where people didn't necessarily have answers, and people are arising to this occasion and saying, well, it really fits here. You know, it really fits. So I don't even know what to make of that, Peter. You know, I've had people from all kinds of faiths and religions, and from all walks of life say, oh, this fits our tradition and this fits our tradition. And I'm going, wow. I just keep just being in awe of this interesting career, and I assume it's just going to keep going in this direction. And I want to just keep, lending myself to that. That's who I am.
You know, Howie, I think that all great educators, all great spiritual leaders, certainly not all great psychologists, but the ones that I appreciate have all talked about bringing out the best in people,
mm-hmm.
about people loving one another, about caring. In psychology, certainly Alfred Adler would be the first one I would think of, but it's the basis of the Judeo-Christian ethic and probably the best of every religious ethic.
Yes.
Psychology has cut itself off from spirituality, you know, academic.
Mm-hmm.
Because fundamentally, I think what you're doing is a very spiritual approach based on loving, valuing, treasuring human beings.
Yes. I think you said two of my favorite key words is cherishing and treasuring other human beings. And I've heard you speak to this, and whether you know it or not, you're one of the few psychiatrists on the planet who's unflappably talks about that in public. And I think you blow people away by that. I think you're right, is that there's not that many people in these primarily academic professions who are out there teaching this message that's the essence of so many traditions. And yeah, I am, and I just have found my way to a way of saying it that seems to get people to go, oh, that makes sense. You know, the lucky thing for me is, and the unfortunate thing in the world right now is there is so many people struggling with kids, and I think we have more intense kids than ever, and I think attempts to use traditional, conventional, old stuff are backfiring, and so many people are looking for answers, and they find their way to transforming the difficult child, and they throw out another ray of hope, and if they read what I say and it makes sense to them, then, you know, and if they start honoring their child more and cherishing and treasuring them more, I absolutely feel that's a spiritual experience. And if by way of that treasuring, the child wakes up to who they are as a collaborative, thoughtful, considerate human being, then that probably will ripple out in their life and have positive repercussions. I think, you know, I think that's the essence of spirituality. If I wake up tomorrow morning and I feel a fraction more compassionate and loving, you know, that's, to me, that's the, you know, a real basis of my spirituality. You know, bringing and manifesting what's in my heart out into the world. And I think that's what we're helping kids do.
Howie, tell people the names of your books in the context of what each of them would be good for folks who want to read your books.
Okay. Well, Transforming the Difficult Child is my original work. It's almost 15 years old now, and it's been updated as recently as this year. And it really, it's the key book in explaining kind of behind the scenes, not only the nurtured heart approach, but what it is in intense and challenging kids that that is important to understand and important to comprehend in light of changes that are pivotal and that will impact them the most. There's a workbook that goes along with that, with the same title. And then my primary book for educators, which has become a very big part of my work, it's called Notching Up the Nurtured Heart Approach. And there's a workbook for that. And the beauty of that book is I wanted to get on paper in case I died tomorrow, you know, what I did in particular with very, very, very challenging kids, how I took the normal nurtured heart approach, and when push came to shove, if I had to, I dug my heels in and took it up a notch, and then took it up a notch. And, you know, there are kids I meet who I have to take it up 20 notches before it kind of registers, and they go, okay, I don't have to act out.
You got to describe that. Describe taking the nurtured heart approach up a couple of notches. Give us
absolutely. Thank you for that. So what I'm going to do in a case like that is, I think the big mistake people make when they're using any approach, and the kid is beyond that level of the approach, I think we revert to getting upset, and we give energy to negativity, and we start getting punitive. I believe with all my heart that kids these days don't awaken to who they are by way of increasing punishments and increasing the drasticness of consequences. I believe the real awakening is to our greatness. So my work in notching it up is I want to dig my heels in. First and foremost, I'm not going to give energy to negativity. How can I get squeakier, cleaner? Second thing I do is how can I take it up a notch in terms of the positive side? How can I say things that resonate more deeply? How can I say more striking appreciations? How can I notify this child, confront them ever more strongly with how great they are? And then the third thing I look for is how can I add some new rules that will make the line more crisp, just like the line around a sporting event. How can I then use the line to discern what rules aren't being broken? To me, that's huge, because you could have a kid who rolls their eyes and they're totally mad about something that happened, and they look like they're going to break a rule, but they don't. I want to jump in and say, I want to tell you about your greatness right now. You look like you want to retaliate. Your sister teased you, and you are. It's so apparent that you're frustrated, but you didn't retaliate. You didn't call her names. You didn't cuss and swear, and you could have. And that shows me your good judgment. That shows me your thoughtfulness. That shows me your wisdom and power. That's where I really want to take it up a notch. And then maybe the last thing as I look at that whole cycle is, you know, if I'm a parent of that child and the child's still not responding fully, transformatively to what I'm doing, you know, I want to use my frustration as fuel. I want to feel my feelings. And if I'm angry at this kid, I don't want them to see my anger. I want to just kind of dive deeper and use my anger as like a impetus to go next steps. Well, maybe I'm leaking energy to negativity. You know, is my child perceiving they're getting any relationship at all through their negativity? You know, old habits die hard, you know, and some kids they have to really see if you've really changed, or if you're just pretending to change, and if you're gonna revert to energizing negativity. So, you know, you gotta just dig your heels in. Or they'll believe, you know, you don't really know them, and you're just saying these compliments to manipulate them, so they have to push you real hard to see that you will continue to give them these compliments. And this is the new you and the new way of life. So notching it up is along those lines and digging deep. And so I wrote about that for educators, but I've had a lot of parents read that book and transpose it to notching it up for themselves. And then I have the You Are Oprah book, which, you know, when I decided 10 years ago to use the nurtured heart approach on myself, guinea pig number two, you know, guinea pig number one was my dear daughter, who was born into, you know, she was just happened to be born at the time this was all coming about. And she's a most marvelous young lady. She's 22 and just an exquisite human being. And I think the world of her.
her greatness, and she lives her greatness. And then 10 years ago, I started using this on myself, and I wound up writing about it 5 years ago in this book called You Are Oprah, and it was my attempt to inspire adults to see the greatness in themselves and the greatness in other people. And it hasn't been nearly as popular book, but it's, you know, there's been some great feedback about it. And I'm currently writing a book called Igniting Greatness, and I'm very excited about that. I've been writing a lot in the last month, and it's, you know, I've written a lot in the last couple of years for this new book, and all of a sudden I'm on fire again, so I like when that happens. Most of my work is
Howie?
Yeah. Can I give a little plug for where people could find my work?
That was going to be my next. I have two things I wanted to do. Yes, give the plug, which is the second thing I was going to ask you.
The children's, you can look up my name, howardglasser.com, or you can look up difficultchild.com, or childrenssuccessfoundation.com. And all of those URLs will lead to the Children's Success Foundation site. That is the home of the organization that is the training organization for this approach. And there's all kinds of online classes, and there's books, and there's much more information about this approach. And if people sign up for that, they for free, they'll get a 10-part video series called Propelling Your Child to Greatness. It's every 3 days you will get a free 4-minute video with another, for 1 month you'll get, like, every 3 days, 4 minutes of me talking about another aspect of how to propel greatness in children. So hopefully you'll find that well worth your time and efforts. What was the question before that, then?
Well, you actually started to address it. In fact, I was trying to interrupt you before. People may have heard me trying to interrupt you, and then you actually went on to talk about this issue, but I'd like you to address it some more. I think that one of the main things that people must feel when they hear you talk about the way you relate to the children and adults too is people are going to think it's phony and manipulative and unreal. Address that. Talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I'm very sensitive to that. I do not like the, you know, I may be giving Pollyanna a bad name. Maybe I'm misunderstanding Pollyanna, but it's not this falsetto version of good job, or it's not inauthentic. I really coach people to being very genuine, of seeing the beauty of these children. And, you know, I wrote a book called All Children Flourishing, too. You know, I really feel we could help kids to flourish by genuinely appreciating them. I think our world has these shortcuts. We have a very skimpy way of seeing the beauty of kids by saying thank you and good job. And, you know, I've gone around the room, you know, so many times of people coming to my talks and saying, you know, good job, way to go, excellent. And I point people out and I go, wow, that's great. And then I say, you know, I'm in a room full of intelligent people. Please tell me what I'm obviously approving of something. Tell me what I'm approving of. And people have these blank looks, you know, good job and thank you kind of comments are very vague. They don't have information. So I really am striving for people to find their voices and say what it is they're appreciative of. What are they being thankful for? And I try and give them lenses to see the beauty in their kids and to see the beauty from different angles. Here's the rules you're not breaking, Peter. You're not being rude and you're not being interruptive, and that shows me the greatness of your inquiring mind. You care so deeply. You want to hear what I have to say, and I really appreciate that. But in the meantime, I'm telling you rules that you're not breaking, and I'm accusing you of, I get to accuse you of being this wise, thoughtful person. I think I help people to see that they are the producers and directors of every moment, to stay with the truth of the moment. You know, your child might be out of control 24/7, at least you might think that, but the truth is, right this second, they're not being out of control. I want you to let them know how much you're appreciative. Surely, when they're out of control, that must be very not great. And so the important thing right this second is to tell them how great it is that they're not cussing and swearing and arguing and fussing and having meltdowns. And when they start doing that, it stops the adults in their track too, and they go, "Oh my God, that makes total sense." You know, we're so good at being descriptive when it comes to bad things. We have this language of failure down pat, and we could wax poetically about failure. We're really minimalists when it comes to our poetry for what's right. And I say a few things to motivate people.
Howie, we're coming to an end.
Oh my God, it's such a pleasure being with you, Peter. Thank you for letting me express myself.
This is Howie Glasser. His messages are absolutely marvelous. Get involved. And Howie's an incredible demonstration of finding your own voice, your own way of helping other human beings, and then actually broadcasting that voice.
Mm.
And you've done a very, very fine job of that. And I'm so glad to have you on the show again. And personally, let's stay in touch. And just thanks very, very much.
Thanks, Peter. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share my work.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And folks, don't forget, I'll be in New York City the weekend of October 26th. Go to R.D. Lang in the 21st Century. Google it, R.D. Lang in the 21st Century. Thank you.